started. Call the roll, please.
Okay. Bruce Bastian. Tomas Boynton. Terry Brown is excused. Judy Diversa. Greg Fagan.
Here.
Michael Fitzpatrick.
Here.
David Flanagan.
Here.
Richard Gonzalez is excused. Glenn Harvey.
Here.
Bill Klein.
Here.
Josh Montefusco.
Here.
Tino Pena is excused. Andrew Thompson.
Here.
And Myron Newman.
Here.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. First on the agenda is the motion to adopt today's agenda. Motion by Glenn.
Second.
Second by Bill. Anybody
can I
have...
ask to react to the agenda as introduction of the new member?
I usually cover that in your comments from the chair.
Okay.
But,
that's fine.
Historically.
Okay.
But if you'd like to have a separate, we can certainly do that. Okay. Thank you for pointing that out. Does anybody have any additions, changes, deletions to the agenda? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Next, we have need a motion to approve, hopefully, the minutes of May 3rd, 2017, our last meeting.
So moved.
Motion by Glenn.
Second.
Second by Myron. Does anybody have any corrections, deletions, additions to the minutes? Seeing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Comments from the chair. I'd like to welcome Josh to the, what is the proper pronunciation?
Montefusco.
Montefusco. Welcome.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to either myself or any other members in any way.
Can I ask Josh?
Do so in a public setting. Did we learn that last time?
Not on any agenda.
Yes.
Yes. And want to introduce yourself and any, tell us a little about yourself?
Sure.
You.
Right. So as stated, my name is Josh Montefusco. I moved to West Palm Beach almost 2 years ago now. I graduated from Georgia Southern University almost 2 years ago now. I did some summer school and then started here with Kinley Horn and Associates almost 2 years ago. So it's all kind of happened at the same time. I recently had a son.
Congratulations.
And moved to Palm Springs all in a 2 week period. He was born and moved, and that was kind of chaotic. But
and you're still married?
And I am still married, yep.
Planning or engineering?
Engineering and traffic engineering.
And traffic, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Well, where'd you grow up originally?
I grew up in Georgia, but I was born in upstate New York.
Okay.
Plattsburgh, New York, England.
A couple of New Yorkers here, I think.
Okay.
Maybe. Got a lot in the county. Well, welcome, Josh. Thank you. Thank you.
And you were appointed by?
I'm sorry, I'm so new to this area and everything.
Is it Joni?
Joni. Yeah, Brandon. Yeah, thank you.
And she's Vice Mayor of Palm Springs?
Correct.
Okay, great. Okay, next on the agenda, the CAC Liaison's Report.
Mm-hmm. New FDOT Secretary is announced, Mike Dew, was on June 5th, going through a selection process. I have four main people to interview for that. Mike served as the FDOT Chief of Staff for this position. And then one other update I want to mention, the US 1 Multimodal Corridor Study. We already had our public meetings and finished our public outreach in Boca Raton. And now we are headed to Delray and Boynton in June, so this month.
That's good.
What are those dates?
Sure, so you should have it on your...
I can just read it.
Well, I can mention too, though. Workshop is on June 24th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. I believe it's a Saturday. And then on the Monday to Wednesday, June 26th to 28th, is the Open Studio in Charette. So that's more like a drop-in throughout the day to go and work with and help sign.
Okay, thank you. Major, any questions, anybody? No?
Just make a quick comment. I'm from Boca, and we had the first set of charrettes and public engagement took place, I guess, a couple weeks ago. And I went to a bunch of them, and they were terrific. And I can say, too, that in Boca, there's this set of people, I'm not one of them necessarily, but there's a set of people who think that the government doesn't really listen to them very much. And having the type of public engagement that we did, that the MPO did as part of this study, was much, much, much appreciated by those folks there. So I'd say hats off to the MPO for that.
Great.
And thank you for growing so much of it on social media.
One of the few things I'm good at.
Very good.
Awesome. Great. Okay. Moving on. Are there any members of the public that are here that would like to speak on any items today? If you are, raise your hand. And seeing none, close that portion of the regular items on the agenda. And we'll move on to action item 2A, the fiscal year 2018-2022 transportation improvement program, draft executive summary. It's in your package. Second reading.
Correct. So it looks something like this, maybe probably colored versions of what you see. So this is our second reading of the draft TIP, this year 18-22. So last month it came to you all for the first reading, just informational purposes. And so today it is an action item. So a few slides to go through, it won't be as long as the last presentation. Again, this is a schedule of how this plays out. Again, last month we had in May the draft TIP for informational purposes. Now we are here where that arrow is in June for as an action item. And then after this, we would be operating, if approved by the board, under fiscal year 18 through 22, starting in July. And we also have this on this slide the schedule going all the way up to the next fiscal year, 19-23 TIP. And the reason we have it on here is to show you all the steps that sort of happen before we even get to the point we are today. So you can see kind of playing out this next role of 19 through 23. So the priority list going before the board next month in July, and a draft work program coming out from FDOT in October. And so that's all building up to the product list going forward from 19 to 23. So that's the same process that happened for the one we're looking at today, 18 through 22. This is a quick note to show you where on the website you can see the executive summary, which is in your pack there, and then also the full document under the draft TIP fiscal year 18-22. So it's over 100 pages, a pretty good reading there. 159, okay. You can go in there. It's not too large of a file. It should be a pretty good size to download, but it shouldn't take too long. You can see the website, palmbeachmpo.org, and you can just put /TIP there, and it'll direct you to the site. So that's where the general public would go to see the whole document. Again, I just wanted to mention the main products that go into the TIP in kind of general categories here. And you can see the sections in the TIP document, how it's sorted. So we have those MPO priority projects, those major MPO projects that are prioritized, and then also the competitive process, local initiatives program, transportation alternatives program, and the shared use network trail, Sun Trail program. There's also included the strategic intermodal system capacity projects from FDOT. We have other projects in here as well from FDOT that don't fall in those other categories. And then also all the local projects. So we request all the locals' jurisdictions submit their projects so we can have this informational purposes in our TIP, and those are paid for by property tax ones, the impact fees, other revenues that go towards those projects outside of this federal and state funding, and also other airport, railroads, and seaport projects, again, that weren't already captured in the other MPO priority projects or FDOT priority projects. And then lastly, which is a big chunk of the money as well, maintenance and operations. We have three categories for that: major maintenance projects, operation maintenance of roadways, and operation maintenance of trains. So these are the sections that you'll see in the document of the TIP. A few updates that we've done since the last time we showed this to you for informational purposes. last meeting, mapped a series by construction year. So you only saw in your packet, I think, fiscal year 18, but the other ones are created and on the website now, and we have them all the way out to 2022, and it goes by fiscal year construction. So if there's construction happening within the TIP, it'd be on one of these maps. And they're all 11 by 17, so not down to an 8.5 by 11, but they're enough to print out on an office computer most of the time. And they provide pretty good reference for locations of projects.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
I think it's just terrific to have these maps. I think they're very good. These are the funding for construction in FY18.
Correct.
So it doesn't include on the maps the projects that were funded in previous years that are actually due to start construction in FY18.
That's a good point, yes. So when we try to catch it and it's not, like, for example, what you're saying, it wouldn't be in the TIP anymore, but it's still going to construction now, where there's no funding there, so it most likely will not show up in the TIP.
Well, you know, the first two projects under major category were projects that were previously funded in previous years, but are scheduled for construction in FY17. So they don't show. They are they are listed in the TIP, but they're not on the maps. This is not a big deal. I think the map's terrific. It's an amazing job that you compile all this stuff and present it. I think you do a terrific job. My only concern is that in communication, and this is perfect for, I think, communicating with the board members, but in communicating with the public, I think it would be more effective if you could actually have maps like this that show what's actually scheduled for construction in FY18, not what's budgeted, that the construction money comes in the budget. It's a difference between budgets, which I know all about, and what's really happening, because the public is really interested in what's really happening. And so if it's possible for the online versions, for example, for the public that they're going to see, if they can see something I've said my piece.
I agree, yes. I think it's either we could look into either adding those projects under that fiscal year 18, or we could maybe have an under construction map.
And under construction, so yeah. Good.
Right.
Yeah. Planned construction in FY18. You know, budgeted FY18, planned construction in FY18. Because there's a difference. And
to add to what Myron was saying, one of the things I noticed in scanning the 159 pages on my iPad and going through it is I got to the point where it just showed me the map. I don't have time to read 159 pages, so I go right to the map. It's just 18. It's 19, 20, 21, 22, and it doesn't say what was previous in 17. Mm-hmm. So if a public member is going to scan it, they want to, just show the damn plan so I can just see if my little road is in there. That could be helpful. So do what was already previously funded in 17 as background, and then maybe do each year, whether it's either budgeted or under construction. I agree with Myron. I think the construction is probably more helpful to the public. And I can read it and figure, okay, out a year, but to see what it looks like. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to confuse the data that's in the chart, but at the same time, I think a map can tell 1,000 stories,
yep.
And it's a lot faster than reading 59. Someone, I'm asked all the time, when are they doing something on that road? I can memorize what the map looks like, but I can't memorize one page out of 159. I can memorize a map, just pictorial.
Yeah, looking at this map was really terrific.
It's a great graphic.
And, you know, it's color-coded. And another thing that would be helpful is if there was some color coding in the TIP that corresponded to this color coding. So you could
bring in one map with five different colors and five different years or something. Just, anyway.
By the way, fiscal year 18 starts when?
So the state fiscal year is going to start in July.
Okay.
But then, yes, this year. And then the federal fiscal year starts October 1st. So there's some lag there.
Okay. Any other comments from anyone?
Oh, I can keep going a little bit. Okay. Almost done. Right. So another thing kind of related to the map, so providing commonly referenced locations for project descriptions. Now, it was brought up at your last meeting about having a canal map. And to get at this, we're hoping that the map can hopefully provide some, you know, insights to that, so where these locations are. And then when we try to go through the projects and change those project descriptions. So if it's only referencing a state road number, actually have that local name in there instead of that or with that. As well as there's a few of all the ones in the county projects only have the termini from like a certain canal point to a roadway. So we're trying to go back and make sure we put where the nearest roadway is, a better descriptor instead of just what the canal name is. So when we find those, we try to correct those. Nothing changes content-wise, you know, the actual substance, I mean, but at least the description can be enhanced, more easily understood. And then other notable projects, this is a quick thing. So two projects that have come before you before.
Your time is up.
I-95 at 45th and I-95 at Southern. So the first one, I believe, is coming to board or coming to committee for next month. And then I-95 at Southern has been deferred to later. So this one points out that they are in the TIP, but the fiscal years for PE in the right of way are in the out years for 21 and 22. So these are two projects that the committees and then the board will be given a future opportunity to vote on for the recommended improvements, where they approve those, deny them, or have modifications to those recommendations. And then last slide we have. One of the recommendations from the committees was to somehow track the LOTP projects and how we're doing with getting those done. So we're turning those plans into actual implementation. So in our LRTP, we have a cost feasible plan with all the projects, and they're categorized by strategic intermodal system, term pipe projects, NPO funded projects, so that's money dedicated strictly from the NPO funding, and then Palm Beach County funded projects, which are capacity projects from the county. You can see here the amount that are in the cost feasible plan, the number of projects I mean, and then how many we have completed to date, and then how many are scheduled or programmed with phases in the fiscal year 18 through 22, and then ones that are not yet funded yet, and then other ones that were removed or are now being implemented through some other means. So you can see there the breakdown.
Are not yet funded, you mean not yet budgeted?
Correct. So they are part of the long-range plan, but
right.
Not in the TIP. And I think that's my last slide. Yeah.
Okay. Any questions? Any members?
One quick, the I-95 Southern, is that the labor reason?
Is that a better?
Is that tied to our president? Is it a disruption?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'll take a stab at that. I think what Andrew meant when he said that was that the presentation of the alternative that will be recommended at that interchange is coming at a future meeting. That presentation is not imminent. It's not next month. It'll be coming later this fall or early 2018. The funding for that project has not been known. The funding in the TIP is pretty consistent with, I think, what our adopted 17 through 21 TIP has in it. He was just referring to when DOT is going to come back and share updates with the board. And the reason for that, in case you're interested, is when they presented the alternatives to the NPO board for the I-95 Southern Boulevard interchange, all three of them had overpasses, and the NPO board said, we don't like any of them. And so they're sort of in, they're working out a compromise solution right now that they think will be agreeable to our elected officials. They being DOT is working on that.
West Palm Beach fought the I-95 direct connect to the airport flyover for a long time because of the height. So I would imagine that's one of the issues of those flyovers.
It very much is, yes.
I mean, that was a big issue, but sure is nice to go to the airport now. Thank you. Okay. Anyone has any questions, comments? Yes, Glenn?
On table six, significant changes from 17 to 21. The turnpike from Blaze to from Broward County line to Atlantic to Boynton, this all expands from 6 to 8. Is that a change from what they were originally contemplating from going from 6 to 10?
So this is
the on table six, it shows three projects from the Broward County line to Boynton Beach, which is currently 6 lanes. I thought my understanding was that they were going to expand it from 6 to 10 lanes. So it shows only the 8 lanes here. And I was wondering if that's a change. Is that
it's
accurate or is it? That'll change. What's the background?
Let me get with the turnpike and make sure that I give you the definite answer. The change we were highlighting on the first two was that construction funds are delayed. They
right.
were in fiscal year 20 and 21. Now they're going to be built later.
Right.
We are not intending to convey a change in the scope of the project. I think
right.
they still want to build it to a 10-lane section. So I'm not sure where that note came from.
Okay.
But it's my understanding that they're still trying to do 10 lanes. That's still in excess of what is in our long-range plan. And there still will be an LRTP amendment coming before this committee and the board to justify the widening. Did it come to this committee already?
It came
here.
We had
you guys talked about it.
We had a discussion about it. The issue of going 8 to 10 came to the two canals on each side of the turnpike and not having an
yes.
adequate solution for handling the water from it. So it was perhaps 10 if they can work out that issue with the two canals on each side of the basically turnpike canal. That's what it was, as
okay.
I recall, and that was the DOT presentation.
Okay. One of the hot conversation topics in our technical committee has been whether or not the introduction of a toll within a toll on the turnpike corridor is something that our community should support. And so they've been wrestling with that and haven't really endorsed that recommendation by the turnpike to create what they're calling express lanes within the turnpike corridor with limited entry and exit points to those express lanes. That's the part, that amendment and the additional lanes in the corridor have not gone to the MPO governing board for approval yet. They're still, we're waiting for more information from the turnpike to satisfy some of the technical committee's concerns and to present that to the governing board for approval.
Okay.
Thank you. That being said, I think the scope of work is still intended to widen the corridor to 10 lanes. Whether those internal two additional lanes will be managed lanes or general lanes remains to be seen. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments on this? This is an action item. We need a motion to.
Is there a motion before we discuss it?
Oh.
Okay. I have some questions, but I'll
okay.
move to approve it.
Well, I think we have a discussion.
Usually, Robert's Rules of Order, get to have something in discussion, you have to have a motion. You don't have to vote. You don't vote on it yet. You just have a motion. And then you can discuss it. So I move approval.
Okay. A motion to approve. We have a second?
Second.
Second by Andrew. Okay. Comments? Discussions.
I have a couple of questions about particular items. In table one, item number 8, which is the extension of Tri-Rail to Jupiter. In the note says $73,843 need FDOT to restart PD&E. So the FDOT's can stop the PDD. Is that, yeah, that we're perfect at that. That's they take off.
My suggestion to the committee is that we have a representative from Treasure Coast here to make a full presentation updating you on the status of that corridor as your next information item. So maybe we, I don't want to steal your thunder.
All right. Let me ask a question on table two, item 13.13-5, which is the installation of the adaptive traffic control system on PGA Boulevard. It says construction April 2017. This is June 2017. I haven't seen any construction yet. Is it something going on? Or has that been delayed?
The short answer is when we created this, the summary table, that was the date in the DOT's work program to commence construction, to issue a notice to proceed for that contract. Now, whether that notice to proceed is followed immediately by orange cones and barrels and whatnot. But I believe the notice to proceed has been issued.
But there's no real delay. It's going to be...
I'm not aware of a delay on that project, but we can look into the details of it and get back to it.
And again, same table, item 1410, is the project is called Video Camera Detection, but apparently it's replacing inductive loops with video cameras in 27 places, not specified. But is this in connection with further rollout of adaptive traffic management? Or is this just giving up on loops?
This is giving up on loops, in short. It's not accompanied by an extension of fiber optic cable connecting to this 27 locations. We have the 27, they're in the application by the county. We just didn't list them all because of space.
Oh, that's fine.
But the general sense is that video detection is more reliable and has come down so much in cost that it's better to invest in video detection than to continue to restore cut wires in pavement loops that have proven to be unreliable over time.
And just for, you know, so like a better understand video detection as opposed to loops, is there a person watching the video, or is it a machine that's watching the video?
It's a machine monitoring change in pixels in a particular drawn box on a video camera screen that is oriented in the same direction. It's not movable. It's not zoomable. These are cameras mounted on arms on signal heads, like the mast arms that stick out over the intersection. They look across the intersection. We draw little boxes on the screen and say, watch the pixels inside that box. If they change color, there's a car there. Make sure the light stays green long enough to change it back to asphalt color.
Good. Makes sense.
That's the short version.
Yes, no, that's very helpful. Yeah. I just want to, you know, just for clarity, I want to make sure I understand what's going on.
I have a question about that. Is that image, are those images stored for any length of time?
No.
If you're looking for,
in fact, we have
Robert later on.
In fact, we have video detection cameras at the signals, and we also, and I'm using we generally, not the MPO, the county and the DOT together have purchased and maintained this infrastructure. They have surveillance cameras that are high-mast cameras that can actually be turned in different directions, used to pan, tilt, zoom, and they have relatively high resolution to be able to observe incidents and to change signal timing. None of those video feeds are recorded as a matter of policy by the county. So there's no usefulness today because of their current procedures with respect to kind of crime-solving purposes or any other observational purposes that you might come up with. We've had a lot of attorneys ask for that video feed, and it doesn't exist.
This is a live feed.
It's a live feed to allow operators in the control room down the hall to make real-time signal changes to adapt to issues and incidents on the road.
Those live feeds there, are they on some of them on the internet or available or not?
Yes, they are, either through the DOT's website, and several of our news media stations have been given access to those camera feeds for their news broadcasts, and they make some of those links available on their own website. So there's a county traffic management website you can go to, there's a DOT traffic management website, and we can get that information to Andrew and provide it to you.
Okay. Any other questions, comments on the motion that we have on the floor? Okay, seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries unanimously. All right, next item, information items. Item 3A, the Tri-Rail Coastal Link Update. Kimberly.
Good afternoon. Sorry about that. Kim Delaney from Treasure Coast RPC. Thanks for the opportunity to present. I haven't been here for a couple of months. I have a brief presentation for you today, but I can dive as deep on any of the details as you like. I was asked to keep it to 10 slides. I made it to 11, so that's pretty good for me. By way of reference, for those of you who I don't know, the Regional Planning Council is one of 10 regional planning councils in the state. The Treasure Coast region runs from Palm Beach County up to Indian River County. Not only are we staffed to the MPO, but we're also staffed to FDOT. And in fact, we're charged with the Tri-Rail Coastal Link Project in conducting and helping coordinate public outreach with local governments, with public agencies, members of the public, and whomever. So that's kind of our role in the effort. And so I have a brief overview for you of kind of the high points that I'd characterize as kind of the most relevant data in the past 12 months, just to be aware of as an advisory committee. The project's been lagging a bit because the All Aboard Florida project has frankly stolen a lot of the thunder with respect to passenger rail. And so actions related to All Aboard Florida have needed to reach points of resolution before another form of passenger rail can advance on the corridor. And so that's just kind of in the sequence of things. The project had been moving along at a much faster clip until the All Aboard Florida project was introduced. And that project, again, has kind of shifted the energy, if you will, towards the completion of that first phase of service, which is nearing a point of completion, actually, as we speak. And so with that, can we zoom in, by the way, with this PowerPoint? Do you have the ability to zoom? Because I'm going to want to zoom in on the section. Oh, we do. Okay, so hang on for a moment. So this map illustrates the latest service concept for the Coastal Link project. And Coastal Link is a term now that really encompasses all Tri-Rail service. So existing Tri-Rail service, of course, exists out here on what is the CSX corridor. And so there are 18 stations within 72 miles that represents today's Tri-Rail service. It carries about 16,000 people a day by frame of reference. A lane of traffic on I-95, a lane of roadway rather, carries about 20,000 cars. So that's kind of the volume of what's not on I-95 competing for that same space. Again, 18 stations in 72 miles. With respect to existing Tri-Rail service, the latest improvement is at Miami International Airport. So if you have ridden the system all the way down, what you would find is that there's now a new station, which is in the MIC, Miami Intermodal Center. It's a billion-dollar project that took about 20 years of planning and construction. Now that it's done, it's pretty phenomenal. So if you're flying out of Miami International Airport, you can literally roll your luggage out of the Tri-Rail train and roll into the airport. You go through the rental car facility, which was a major investment in that area to kind of clean up the rental car havoc that had existed over time. And you actually roll through that facility into the terminals. So that's now the terminal station, kind of a nice improvement, and really evidences the regional connectivity that's provided with passenger rail. There are a couple of things just to note. One of those is this connection that's shown right here. This guy is called the Northwood Connection. So this is running along about 25th Street in West Palm Beach. That connection is necessary to enable Tri-Rail service to continue north onto the FEC and make a crossover. This has been long identified as the necessary crossover for Tri-Rail service to make it up to Jupiter. The Northwood Connection was funded through a TIGER grant, Transportation Investments Generating Economic Recovery, it's the acronym TIGER. So about 4 years ago, FDOT, the SFRTA, and both the FEC and CSX contributed funds towards pulling down what was a $32 million TIGER grant. That grant is funding the construction of this crossover, again, around 25th Street. It will ultimately be built with what is essentially two Ys on either side. The way the crossover is configured now, it's very easy to take trains that are running south and continue south on the FEC, but it doesn't make it easy for trains to go north and across north onto the FEC. They'd have to make kind of a K-turn, which is not a turn that's desirable if you're running a train. So instead, those turns will be normalized to make it easy for that service to continue. That Tiger Grant also funded this guy down here. This is a connection called the Iris Connection, and that runs between the FEC and CSX down by the airport, and it will enable all aboard Florida trains, in fact, Tri-Rail trains to run into what is all aboard Florida's station, which is down here. I'm going to just click another time. All aboard Florida stations are identified in the yellow. So in terms of building the system, ultimately, we have this connection under construction. We have this connection under construction. The other station, just to mention, there's now a PD planning project development process that's beginning to locate a new station in Boca Raton. That would be around Glades Road. So if you've been around the project for a while, there's a property that was referred to as the King's Deli. The Deli property is the rough location for where a new station is being envisioned. Boca Station now being the busiest station of the 18 stations in Tri-Rail Corridor, which is pretty significant as far as ridership for Palm Beach County. Again, it keeps us well positioned, I think, in terms of the regional importance of the project. And that station would be the next new station to be constructed out here on the CSX. Oops, didn't mean to do that. Let's go backwards to that one. And there we go. So the Tri-Rail Coastal Link project, which again, that term is kind of defined in different ways. Some people call just the actions over here on the FEC the Coastal Link service, and in some contexts, Coastal Link is now referred to kind of as the whole package. So take that as you will. What was most recently referred to as Coastal Link is the service that would exist on the FEC corridor, running between Jupiter and all the way down to downtown Miami. Okay, and so that service is being delivered in a series of segments. So the first segment of service is called Miami Link. So these all become links then, if you will, but they're not all completely well defined as of yet, so know that. That said, the Miami Link service is the idea that Tri-Rail trains will come across this new connection and go all the way into the downtown Miami station when all aboard Florida, just after all aboard Florida begins service. So that service into downtown Miami is under construction now. Tri-Rail took a leadership role in helping assemble financing from a whole host of public agencies in Miami-Dade County. And so it's kind of a remarkable assemblage of public partnerships with a private sector partner, the FEC, and all aboard Florida, a division of Fortress Investment Group, which owns all aboard Florida and FEC, to deliver this service. And so there's funding that was assembled from Miami-Dade County, from a series of community redevelopment agencies, from the Miami Downtown Development Authority, in total about $32 million in funding, to enable Tri-Rail to construct its platforms in the second story of the All Aboard Florida station, which is the Miami station called Miami Central. The only way Tri-Rail would be able to provide service there would be for those platforms to be constructed before that train station opened up. And the way the facility is located down here, the train begins to rise, the tracks rise at 2nd Street, and the trains come in to a second story. And that was to avoid impacting the roadway network at a pinch point. And because those tracks are elevated, Tri-Rail either had to get in on day one or was never going to get into that station. And so, again, the RTA took a leadership role and really worked pretty effectively in assembling that public financing. That platform is under construction. All aboard Florida has indicated it expects to begin its phase one service, which will run from West Palm Beach to Fort Lauderdale. That service is supposed to begin around September of this year, and that's latest estimates from FEC, from all aboard Florida. And then the next piece of that, so kind of like phase 1B, running from West Palm all the way down into downtown Miami, that would begin maybe in October or so. Tri-Rail has indicated it will be ready to begin service by January. And so by January, Tri-Rail service will be traveling down the CSX corridor, and then when it gets to this point, 26 of the 20 of the 50 daily trains will go directly into what is Miami Central, and 24 of those trains will have a connection that meets it, and you'll be able to continue into Miami International Airport. And the flip happens for the other 24 trains a day, which will have direct service into the airport, and then you make a connection into downtown Miami. Okay? So, really, that's the first phase of service that is considered the Coastal Link, which is that service into Miami Central. The other piece of that Miami Link service is service running up to maybe about Aventura. This is kind of a nicely packaged piece of service that Miami-Dade County has prioritized as a very important part of its overall transportation network. The way that service would work, if you're leaving Mangonia Park, let's say, you'd be traveling down the CSX, come across the Iris connection, those trains would go into Miami Central, and then they would travel up to maybe about Aventura. And then they would back down and come back around again. So that would be the continuous service that would be provided. Until a few months ago, that was considered to be a packaged segment of service. And in fact, 2 months ago, Miami-Dade County asked the Department of Transportation to advance the planning on that little package of service. It's fairly well contained. It's not that expensive in the scale of large public rail investments. So it can run through a faster process. And that began to accelerate until there was a realization that, gosh, you know, if we just went a little bit further, we could get up to Fort Lauderdale International Airport before we crossed the New River Bridge. So there is an ongoing discussion as to whether or not this next phase that's imminent in terms of planning will either run up to Aventura or run all the way up to Fort Lauderdale, again, being kind of thwarted, if you will, by about $100 million bridge improvements that's necessary at the New River Bridge in Fort Lauderdale. So that's a component of the project that we will all learn more about in the next few months. The easiest thing to do is to keep it in Miami-Dade County, and then all the funding comes from those same partners. But there's an opportunity to do something a little better, if you think more train stations are better, and most people tend to, which would be to get that service up to Fort Lauderdale International Airport. And so this segment of what is called the Charter Hill Coastal Link will go into what is called the project development phase. So unlike PD&Es for roadway, when train segments, passenger rail segments are analyzed, they're called project development. Same kind of process, just a different term. This section will begin in early 2018, and it should be finished in about 9 months, whether it goes to this point or this point. That's about 9 months of study. And then an accelerated discussion about how you would finance the construction of stations and then pay for operations. Miami-Dade has prioritized operational funding. Broward County has not yet had that conversation. So again, in many ways it might be easier to keep it contained in Miami-Dade County and we get a quick victory with new service, but the jury's still out on what the parameters will be for that piece of study. So that's kind of part one. Part two is the Jupiter extension. And so the Palm Beach MPO has long identified the extension of service up to Jupiter as a top priority in the LRTP and all of the MPO's documents. It is the only section of Palm Beach County that's not served, but those residents pay nonetheless for service as well. As we know, it's a countywide funding source. The Jupiter extension is also a nicely packaged component. It's less than $100 million in terms of the latest capital estimates. That means it can go through a faster process at the federal level to get funding. It is packaged and ready, if you will, to enter again what's called the project development phase. It may enter that phase separately in 2018 and be broken out, if you will, so it can kind of move on its own path, or it may be packaged with the rest of the stuff in the middle. And so that kind of green segment, if you will, all the way down to downtown Fort Lauderdale is the central segment. It doesn't have a name. Maybe it's the Central Link at some point. I'm not sure. A PR firm will name it at some point, and then we'll have a term we can use. But nonetheless, that's the balance of the segment. And so that the balance of the Coastal Link project would run from about West Palm Beach, probably around 45th Street, 25th Street or so, and those trains are going to come across. So from about 25th Street all the way down to really the New River Bridge, or it could be all of Broward County. The New River Bridge is kind of that main point of challenge, if you will, because as a standalone improvement, bridges take a long time to permit, and again, the estimates are it's a $90 to $100 million bridge improvement. FEC wants it to happen, Marine Industries wants it to happen, and the Coast Guard wants it to happen. So those are all good things, but there's still a cumbersome process to work through to get another bridge permitted. Okay, so this is kind of how the project breaks out. As you can see, there aren't lots and lots and lots of stations. So for those of you who've been around the project for a long time, what historically was called the South Florida East Coast Corridor Study, this rolls off your tongue, that had 60 stations. It grew to like 95 stations at some point, because if you have a train station, most cities wanted two. So there were lots of station locations that were identified. And then kind of a new level of thinking, which was to lean the project down to make it easier to permit and easier to finance and construct. Pardon me. And so what you see then is about 26 stations likely. That is kind of the probably close to build out. I mean, maybe a few stations come online after that. But commuter rail wants to operate with a station spacing of about 5 miles, 4 miles or so. And this is an 85-mile segment. So you can do the math. So if we have more than about 25 to 30 stations, we're really not effectively able to run commuter rail service. It kind of starts to get bogged down. And so this is, again, the latest array of stations in Palm Beach County. There would be Jupiter, Palm Beach Gardens, either Lake Park or Riviera Beach. These two are actually being considered as a pair of stations. One of those will probably precede the other. The second one may or may not come online, depending on how ridership looks after a first station goes into place. West Palm Beach at St. Mary's, downtown West Palm, which again is almost completed now, and that is the Allward Florida station that is just south of Clematis Street, Lake Worth, Boynton, Del Rey, and Boca. And that's our array of stations on the FEC corridor. So questions about the map? That's kind of a lot of information, Michael.
I can just report Everglades there. The expanded and new big improved marshalling yard there, how much is that going to affect future commuter rail?
The new freight distribution facility that's by Port Everglades?
Yeah.
I don't think it has any material impact. What we see, and this is a regional planning council perspective, so I'm not an engineer, but what we see with respect to passenger rail and freight movements on the corridor, pardon me, is that the better job we can do in making efficient freight distribution, the more capacity we create for passenger rail service.
How's that work?
So, well, if freight trains are traveling independently instead of together, then you're taking up more windows, right? So the better job we can do at consolidating freight trains and double stacking them if we need to or making them longer, actually create more windows for passenger rail to operate. The other consideration is that once the corridor is double tracked, and that's nearly completed now from West Palm South, you get more than double the capacity because the train tracks can move in both directions. So unlike a road, when you take a road from two lanes to four lanes, you don't get double the capacity. There's a decreasing return on capacity. With train service, it's the opposite. As you double the number of tracks, you more than double the amount of capacity because trains can move around one another with sidings. So the capacity that's created on this corridor as a double-tracked facility is enough capacity to accommodate all the future freight projections, all the Allward Florida service, and Tri-Rail running at 30, 40 trains a day, plus Amtrak. I mean, there's a lot of capacity out there. So with respect to freight distribution and reassembly, the more opportunities we have to do a more efficient job with freight, we just get that much more room out of the corridor. So it's just an efficiency consideration. The other efficiency consideration that's kind of moving through time now, and I don't know if this idea has a home or not, there's a lot of folks in the northern part of my region who really want it to happen, is US 27. So US 27 is a rail corridor that exists kind of out to the west. It gets up towards the lake and goes around the lake and then continues north to Orlando. And so if you want more capacity on the FEC corridor for passenger rail service, and I'm not suggesting that's what FECR wants, right? FECR, the bread and butter for FEC is moving freight trains. But that said, if there's a beneficial financial opportunity for FEC to move some of the long-distance freight, let's say the through trains that don't even stop to service local freight distribution centers, if we can get them out to US 27 and they can just go up the state without any interference, we have a tremendous amount of capacity that gets created. So those freight facilities that are being constructed now all facilitate that. The better a job we can do of breaking down container ships and putting them together in trains, the more efficiency we get across the board. So that's how I see that, and that's how the council, that's the council's position on those facilities. All good. Inland port, even better, if we can find a location for it, because then we free up the corridor where the people are, to allow trains to run that carry people, so make that more efficient. So, other questions about this stuff? I have a lot. It's a little bit of drinking from a fire hose. There's just a lot of information. So, I will go backwards if you like, but I'll just keep going otherwise, okay? All right, so this is kind of the layout of the system. This is the timing with respect to segments. It's kind of where we are, if you will, in terms of planning different pieces. Other topics that I think are topics of relevance for you as a committee and for the NPO is transit-oriented development and the conversation about land use. And I think I've done a TOD 101 with the committee before, but if not, or if you wanted the refresher, the primer, is that transit-oriented development refers to the land use pattern that exists around a transit station or along a transit corridor, right? So what we know as planners is that land use and transportation are inextricably combined, married. They live together in one house. And to have the most efficient system to move people and goods, we need land use patterns that correspond to that. So what happens with transit in particular is that every transit trip starts and stops usually as a pedestrian, right? So you're kind of accessing a train station or you're accessing a bus stop. And then you take transit to your destination, and then you get off the bus, or you get off the train, in this instance, and usually your destination isn't the train station. Usually your destination is somewhere nearby. So the better job we can do in creating efficient land use patterns, the more efficient our transportation facilities are. And that holds true especially for train investments, for transit investments. Land use is the key driver in making systems work. So transit-oriented development, then, is that land use pattern that exists not by accident, it's very much on purpose, around transit systems that really highlights walkability, okay, and mobility. It has higher densities and intensities, ideally, than the stuff surrounding it. It tends to extend about a half mile from a transit stop, a train station, or along a transit corridor, and that half mile is typically the walk shed. That's like a 10-minute, maybe a 15-minute walk shed, depending how slowly you walk. And so that's really where the most intense development activity takes place. You can get a larger walk shed if you have good shade, if you have a really interesting downtown. If you're in West Palm, you can walk 15 or 20 minutes and it still feels pretty comfortable. Same holds true for Delray because there's a good, interesting pedestrian itinerary, the streets are contained, the buildings are set in a location so you don't feel like you're stranded in the middle of nowhere. It has good shade. So the rule of thumb is about a half mile. Pardon me. Parking is a very important consideration with respect to TOD because parking is just really a waste of space. So the better a job we can do in organizing parking, consolidating parking, or eliminating it, the better a yield we get on the land use return, if you will, around a train station. Because it's all a function of economic return. So if we're going to make this stuff work, right, we've got to pay for it. And really, we're going to pay for it out of land use development. And so this is kind of the general definition of how TOD tends to work in our region. It's within about a quarter to a half mile of a station or a transit corridor. It tends to be mixed use with higher density or intensity than what's around it. If you've ever flown in and out of Washington, D.C., that's my favorite example to use. When you fly into D.C., you can see the TOD nodes along the metro when you fly in. When you look at the landscape, it's amazing. It's the best defined visual example to see. So if you fly in the next time to D.C., if you just look, you can see exactly where the metro line is because you have all these little nodes that are popped up around every one of the stations. It is pedestrian and bike friendly, and then controlling parking, again, a baseline consideration for TOD. What we know about TOD is that even in a down market, TOD outperforms other land use forms. So, and this was interesting data that was generated by the National Association of Realtors. So when the economy reset in 2008, one of the trends that was a hot trend that was talked about by ULI and APA and real estate investment groups, the urban investment groups, was looking at this TOD thing. And the question was, well, gosh, you know, this is an interesting trend that we saw happening in 2000. Now the economy's reset, you know, let's see if that really holds true. We have our doubts. And so what the NAR found is that TODs in all the major metro markets outperformed everything else. In fact, the values stabilized and in some places continued to rise while the values of other stuff fell. So the suburban product types fell. And the urban product types maintained value, right? So So this is just kind of an eye-opener for the region. The council would suggest, it's not a theory, it's actually a well-documented trend now, and we see it in all the major metro markets across the U.S. This little chart just kind of illustrates what was happening for TOD product types. So for every type of product type, single family, multifamily, townhouse, rental, owner-occupied, didn't matter. All those values went stabilized or went up, and the other stuff fell. So it's a very sustainable land use trend, and the cornerstone of this is having mobility, right? That's what we work on as the MPO, is moving people and goods. So when we tie those two things together, we get a better yield. Why is that important? Well, if we want to have transit and be able to move around the region, we have to pay for it. And the way that we're going to pay for it, if you're a local government, is using yield on land use. The RTA has very highly prioritized TOD now. And in fact, we just assisted the RTA. We're also staffed to the RTA, by the way. So we just assisted the RTA in walking through a TOD policy for the region. And what the RTA has kind of made as part of its statements, if you will, is an acknowledgement that local governments have land use authority. And there's nothing to suggest that local governments won't continue and deserve to have and need to have land use authority, unless you're in the legislature and there's some home rule stuff that's going on. So just ignore that for now. Like it's the man behind the green curtain. It's the legislative, usurping of home rule. That said, local governments are motivated, they have a vested interest, and they have that kind of control. The SFRTA is going to have transportation authority and giving out stations. So they're the ones who are going to be taking the project through the federal process to make the case for transit investments here, bringing our tax dollars home to invest in this here instead of sending our tax dollars once again to Charlotte, sending our tax dollars to the Northeast, sending them to Austin, sending them to San Francisco. I mean, we do a very good job of funding transit investments all over the country. We don't do a very good job of funding them in the state of Florida. And so that said, the RTA is going to be at bat with the feds trying to bring home funding for a passenger rail service in the form of Coastal Link on the corridor. And the RTA gets very distinct benefits as well from TOD. So the only way to accomplish that is to have some scale of regional cooperation. Because if we're not working together, then we're not going to be successful. The regions that are successful in getting this to happen have a really nice synergy when it comes to these land use transportation approaches, if you will. And so the RTA just adopted a TOD policy, actually. This was just approved by the board back in April. And so I wanted to bring this to the committee's attention. We're going to be assisting the RTA in carrying out the outreach for this new policy that was just adopted by the board. So, and it's the type of policy that you see in regions that are entrepreneurial that do this well, frankly. And so the hallmarks of this policy are the baseline pieces of TOD. Pedestrian friendliness is a minimum criterion to have TOD that's functional. Having an increased mix of uses is absolutely a baseline expectation. And it's not over-retailing. I actually speak every year at Railvolution, which is one of the national rail conferences. And when I've put together panels before with national developers who do TOD, I mean, one of the conversations just 2 years ago, I did a panel on retail specifically, because everyone wants retail. You want to have a Starbucks, and I want to have a coffee shop, another coffee shop, and then a place to buy a newspaper and a dry cleaner, and all this really cool TOD retail. The reality is that retail can't survive without density. So if you don't have the density around that station, it doesn't matter how many trains are running in and out, retail won't make it. Starbucks might put an extra shift on. This is what we learned. So if you have a really busy train station and the Starbucks can survive there because you have enough density and office and residential use to support it, well, in the busy PM peak from 3 to 6 p.m., when there's a lot of people coming in, they'll put on an extra barista. But they're not keeping the doors open because it's near a train station. Keeping the doors open because they have all that activity around it, and the train station is just a complement. The mix of uses speaks to that. Reducing parking requirements is, again, a baseline consideration for the SFRTA. If you're wasting land on parking, then you're wasting the opportunity to get other activities in place that make train stations yield more riders, and then densities. And the SFRTA's position was a goal of 75 units per acre on average. We were very cautious with the board because that's a number that is very scary when you're in northern Palm Beach County. In Miami-Dade County, it's low. In central Palm Beach County, it's now reasonable. There's projects in Delran and West Palm that are at 100, 120 units an acre. And you don't even know it because it's only a five-story building. They're just designed well. It's really a function of design. But nonetheless, those types of densities are the densities that make writers. So as Stephen, as Andrew Frey would say, one of the members of the RTA, that's what puts butts in seats, is that you have a lot of people living nearby. And so that kind of density consideration is something that you'll see as a citizens committee. The local governments will be having this conversation. We're actually tasked with taking this policy out to all the local governments over the next 6 months and having this very detailed conversation, specifically about the two things that are the trickiest, density and parking. Those two are, you can fill commission chambers for a project if you have something a little off the beaten path for density and a little unusual on parking. Well, people go crazy. So we're at a point in time now where we're playing a little chicken and egg. We want to kind of create this better condition when we're still living in a very suburban environment. So, nonetheless, you will see this dialogue at the local government level. You may see some information in the press about it. This will be a long conversation. It's not an easy solution. But this is how we're going to be successful in getting our train stations funded through the FTA. That said, we just got a series of grants from the FTA to do that very thing, which is to look at density and parking and TOD around stations. And so we just picked up an $860,000 pot of grant funds and went through a process to select what ultimately became seven communities that are going to be receiving funds through that grant to do station area planning. Two of them are in Palm Beach County, so we'll be doing a full charrette in the city of Delray Beach. That'll be in about September. And then we're doing a kind of a complete reboot on a station area plan in Palm Beach Gardens. Their station's going to be just south of PGA Boulevard. And they have a really significantly set of changed land use conditions. For the Jupiter extension, by the way, the only way we can fund a Jupiter extension is with a station in Palm Beach Gardens. If we can't get a station in the gardens to work, we don't have enough ridership to get a Jupiter extension. So we're very straightforward about that. The Jupiter station isn't what does it. The Jupiter station actually doesn't even need to happen. The garden station is the station that needs to happen if we're going to run service to the north. And so you'll see some advertising with respect to those two processes. They are intended to create some prototypical solutions, if you will, that can be applied in other places. And so just awareness for you is that you'll see these two things happening in the next couple of months. What lies ahead? I just figured I'd give you a little laundry list of the kinds of things you'll see. So what lies ahead is the completion of the Miami Link. We know we'll have service into Miami Central as of about January, and then we'll have a process that will either determine stations up to Aventura or up to Fort Lauderdale, FTL, Fort Lauderdale International Airport, Fort Lauderdale Hollywood, I always forget the name. Another thing that lies ahead is a determination of what the FEC access fee will be. The FEC has to indicate how much the check has to be for us to get on the corridor. And they did establish an access fee to get into Miami Central. It's $1 million perpetual access fee, which is a great deal. And they said, hey, don't think that's the cost to get on the rest of the corridor. So there's negotiation underway now with the SFRTA as the lead negotiator from the public side to figure out how much is it going to cost to get to Aventura, and then how much is it going to cost to get to Jupiter, so we can have realistic numbers to start to program the financing side. The project development for the other segments, again, that Jupiter extension or the Jupiter extension in the central part, that will begin, so that lies ahead in 2018. So you'll see lots of public hearings and workshops with respect to those segments getting planned out. There is a northern layover facility that is currently funded in the MPO's LRTP. That is just north of the Mangonia Park Station on the CSX corridor. It's going through the final approval process at this point, and that would allow state trains at the northern end of the system to be maintained and serviced, if you will. They'll do a little fueling, they'll be able to clean the trains out and start the morning operations from a northern point instead of running them all the way down to Miami and then all the way back up the corridor, or leaving them in a layover condition as they are now off of Tamarind Avenue in downtown West Palm. The trains are just kind of parked there overnight next to the Marriott and running, idling, because there's no appropriate facility. That facility is funded and will be constructed just north of the Mangonia Park Station. The pilot planning projects I mentioned, those are the grant-funded activities. Those will be completed over the next 12 months. Oh gosh, it's a typo, apologies. MPO's project prioritization to actually fund the next phase of service for the Coastal Link project has to take place, so you'll see that as an action. There's a whole series of financial discussion, necessary to figure out how we're going to pay for capital and how we're going to pay for operating. So you'll see a lot of that dialogue in the next 12 months. Not so much of that will come through the committee, but you'll see it at the county level and you'll see it in local governments. We'd be happy to come back and give you an update when there's something to update you about. I think we have at least 6 months of lead time, maybe 12, before we have some specifics on the finances. And then there will be a finalization of station locations. Some of those will be finalized through the pilot planning work that we'll be doing in the next 12 months. And then the other local governments will need to kind of get on the stick and figure out, you know, if they have property they want to contribute for their station, where is it, and what happens around it. So that's a little overview for you as to where we are. I'm happy to answer questions if you have them. And otherwise, I will fix my typo, apologies, and then that presentation will be available for you as you need it. Michael?
The FEC railroad people, do they own any parcels of land along the corridor now that could be, you know, increased a lot in value if they're incorporated into a transportation oriented design?
They absolutely do. The major landowner on the FEC is FEC. So, yes, FEC is very well positioned to benefit a lot with respect to station location and ancillary development. So FEC reserves the right to approve final station locations. FEC will likely have a substantial increase in value when passenger rail happens because FEC has like six different companies that own the real estate within their various divisions, and they are the primary landowner. So long answer to a short question is yes, they benefit from TOD to a great degree. So,
do you know where these parcels are?
They are, yes, they're mapped. They're mapped out. I can forward a map to you. It was assembled a couple years ago. So not much has changed. So, yeah, they're in all the downtowns, in and around all the station locations. So, and FEC's already been very clear. The Elbert, Florida project is, you don't make money selling train tickets, right? You make money on the development around stations. So we put together a little analysis. Actually, I'll send that to Renee as well, or whomever, to distribute to the committee. We were asked by the council to put together a little summary of the development program around all of Florida stations. And it's like 3 million feet. Class A, office, market rate, retail. They've always been very clear. And the reason there's a benefit to running all of Florida, or Brightline, is because of the station development activity that takes place around the station. They're not shy about that. So they're very straightforward. It's a business deal. The train could run or not run. But the development in prime locations in downtowns, there's real value to that. So same holds true for the other properties they own along the corridor. Again, they're not shy. They're not shy about that. It's a very straightforward business move on their part. So it's capitalism in motion. So, other questions?
Any questions?
Okay.
Thanks,
guys. Sure.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay. Next information item on the agenda is 2045 Long Range Transportation Plan Scope of Services.
Good afternoon. I'm glad you all did not need to take a boat to get here. We got some blue sky for a couple hours. I think I have a little technology issue, but really I only had a few slides so I can speak through this with you all. Basically, the point of this item was to let you know that the next long-range transportation plan update, which will take us out to 2045, is getting kicked off. So as staff, we've been developing the scope of services for the 2045 plan. One thing I wanted to highlight, I don't know if you all had a chance to look in the backup material at the draft scope, but it was quite a bit more succinct than a normal scope of services would be for a long-range transportation plan. And what the intent this cycle to do is to issue task work orders. So instead of having the one big contract go out at once, a lot of this we feel is it would be done as an in-house effort. So there would still be a not to exceed cost with the contract, but it would be a mix of consultant work and in-house work. So some of the things I wanted to highlight that would be new for the 2045 long-range transportation plan is trying to better account for emerging technologies. That can be a little tricky because listen to some experts, you'll hear we're 5 years away from having a huge chunk of the cars being autonomous. Others say it's still a decade or more away. But we do know that there are on-demand travel services that have already taken off. We have delivery services that are taking off. So there are already patterns that are shifting. We also want to look at, assuming that excess capacity does occur on our roadways, if autonomous vehicles and efficiencies increase, we want to start looking at ways we could retrofit some of our corridors to accommodate that excess asphalt that we'll no longer need and strategize ways we can better utilize that space. I'm sure many of you have heard of CIRPM travel demand model, which is the traditional way of guesstimating what future trips on our roadway network would be. This time around, we want to make sure all modes are put on an equal footing. So in addition to just looking at CIRPM modeling, we want to develop walk and bike scores, look at transit, look at transit potential, and really make it a more multimodal or modal travel demand, as we're calling it, instead of just a travel demand model, which is always emphasizing the car. The last 2 points, over the last year or so, there's been a discussion at the county level of evaluating the road impact fee system, and I know that's been brought up to this committee before. And at a meeting that was held a few weeks ago, it was brought up that certain types of projects aren't typically captured in a long-range transportation plan. They tend to be the larger scale projects. So intersection improvements, a lot of which are funded with road impact fees, aren't incorporated into the long-range transportation plan. So we're thinking of looking at better tying together our CMP process, which is an annually updated report. That focuses a lot on our problem intersections and wrapping that into the long-range transportation plan process. And then also potentially using the long-range transportation plan update as a way to review the road impact fee boundaries that exist today and reevaluate where those are located. So the scope highlights, I'm not going to go through each one. These are just laying out the information that was provided in the draft scope to you all. A couple I did want to highlight, talked about the modal, modal travel demand, and that's to make sure that all our modes are put on an equal footing, and it's easier to compare, because right now when you compare a road project and a transit project and a complete streets project, sometimes it feels like it's apple to oranges, so we want to make it a more even playing field. What the strategic funding plan is getting at is, like in the current LRTP, we have our cost-feasible list of projects, but we also have a lot of unfunded needs. So we want to use the strategic funding plan component of this plan is, one, what are other funding sources that we may not have evaluated in the past that we could look to, but also policy changes, because funding is limited, especially when you look at O&M, operation and maintenance, for transit projects. So what are there policy level, state or federal, that could be implemented that would provide more flexibility for the types of projects that we're able to deliver. And the last slide is just, so currently we have the 2040 Long Range Transportation Plan. That was adopted in October of 2014. By statute, that has to be, the next plan has to be updated within 5 years. So the deadline for the adoption of this plan is October of 2019. Ideally, that will happen a few months prior to give a little bit of a cushion. Another point I want to highlight is, while 2040 will be the horizon year for the long-range transportation plan, this time around we want to put more emphasis on the interim year 2030. It's just easier to more accurately gauge financial revenue projections within a 10-year period. We are still required to look out to 2045, but you'll see a much heavier emphasis on the interim year of 2030 in this plan. And like I mentioned, this scope is being developed to be a task work order based approach. So with that, I know I was brief, but happy to answer questions.
Any questions from the
committee?
Yes. So has there been any thought into how to prioritize the improvements, like going in further? Because I know that HCM has the travel time reliability. It's a new methodology that was recently implemented in the HCM that was recently published. Do you know if that's like going to be part of this MPO 2045 long range plan? Or?
That is a great question. And I know as part of the, so looking at the modal travel demand, trying to capture different modes and how to prioritize projects equally, I don't know if I have a super specific answer to that at this point, but that is something that we're looking at as ways to better prioritize our projects and to try to prioritize projects of different modes on equal footing with each other.
I have a general, kind of a general,
sure,
big picture question. Because we've been doing these 25-year plans now for maybe 20 years.
Many years, yeah.
And every 5 years, when they seem to happen, things change. We've had some presentations here to the committee on the autonomous vehicles.
Right.
5 years ago, when we did the last long-range transportation plan, that wasn't even a discussion. And between the last presentation and this presentation, trying to think a little bit maybe out of the box, where we're still in, you know, planes, trains, automobiles, and trains have to connect us to these walking environments. But Palm Beach County is hot, and it has an elderly population that aren't as attuned to walking 3, 4, 10 blocks and jumping on a bicycle, those type of things. And it just seems that there's other cities, maybe like a Pittsburgh area, that are being a little more progressive in this possibility of the autonomous vehicles. And it's a paradigm shift of everything that is being planned here, of the trains connecting these main city hubs and people from the city hubs and everybody working in these corridors. That business model is not model today. There's not these centralized business locations. There's a lot of telecommuting going on, a lot of independence. And I'm just wondering if we're still planning something out for the next 25 years that really isn't as good as we can do, as to, you know, part of a plan is to take you where you want to be, not what the technology is at this moment. And I'm not sure how that is. You guys are transportation. Our new member here is works with Kimley Horn Transportation Planners. I'd love to see this committee presented with some of these other areas and these options of what is happening in these areas. I mean, you take a downtown West Palm Beach or a Delray or a Boca and you say, okay, this area is just autonomous vehicles. You got to park at the perimeter and that's where you go. It's not so much walking. And when you look at the millennials, and there's a lot of data on the millennials that are out there today, they're now starting to have kids, and they're deciding, hey, there's no school here in this great downtown West Palm Beach that I want to send my kids to. And they're now starting to move. They've actually overtaken the baby boomers, for example, and the number of houses that are being purchased. And that's on a national level. So as they maybe change, or these demographic shifts are going through there, that's going to change a lot. I'm not going to jump on a train and go to Fort Lauderdale or Miami for the night for anything. I don't know about other people here, but sometimes you've got to do it. It sounds romantic and exciting until you do it. It's kind of exhausting.
I mean, yeah.
To be quite frank, so it's this great train that goes between Miami and West Palm. That's, you need to have an FPNL headquarters, PGA Boulevard, for example. 8,000, 10,000 employees. Yeah, but is that really, you know, is this really the best that we can do? Is this the best plan? Is this what we want to be when we grow up? Like, the city of West Palm Beach is changing a lot of their zoning from 32 units an acre to 64 for these things. But with, you know, Uber/autonomous vehicles or some concept like that, you can take old mall areas. West Palm Beach, the old outlet mall, the old Palm Beach mall is now an outlet mall. The density that's around there is pretty intense. And that's regenerated itself pretty interestingly, if you haven't been out there lately, as far as activity, all ages, walks of life that are out there. And it's just changing. And that is almost like a city
because it's got the shopping, it's got the restaurants, it's got all of those things. Schools, still a problem. There's not really a lot of mixture, a lot of private schools in that corridor. But it just seems like there needs to be in this plan more thought to the, you know, this paradigm shift of the autonomous vehicles, because everything I'm reading saying it's come a lot faster.
And I think, and one of the pieces I did gloss over, so I know, and I know I touched on for the what's new, you know, emerging technologies, but another new component to this plan would be the scenario planning section, and that would be getting at a lot of what you're talking about. So if we look at different scenarios of not just land use changes, but also those technologies, and like you mentioned, ones of certain areas were only autonomous. I mean, I don't know exactly how that'll look yet, but that is the component where before we develop our needs plan and cost feasible plan is to do that scenario planning and pick a future that we'd then be developing our cost feasible transportation system with. And I know we've looked at Pittsburgh and Austin and a few other areas that are models for certain aspects. So that will all be a big component of this.
And it's more than that. We used to just do a lot of roads here 25 years ago, but now we're doing the majority of the expenditures are at mass transit. As soon as you build that bus network and that train network, you're putting a lot of overhead and a lot of resources in the people and equipment, etc., that you don't necessarily need to do, and it's creating a money-sucking machine that could hurt the ability to modernize to these emerging technologies that are out there. And when you start looking at what it costs just to run the bus system in Palm Beach County, for example, that's a lot of
it's
Uber.
It's not insignificant.
I mean, you can almost give everybody an Uber card for what we're spending in those kind of things. And that's what I'm getting to. It's like there's just a disconnect here that I feel. Can't say for fact, but I'd like to see that. I don't know what the other committee members, but I'd like to see that scenario is okay. What happens if autonomous is 5 years, 10 years, 15, and what does that mean? What does that mean in the budget before we get this billion-dollar money-sucking machine that needs to be funded every month? And it's really hard to get rid of people. I just read an article a couple days ago about cabbies. Their jobs are over in major cities.
Right, this Lyft and Uber and those services.
I mean, would you ever have thought that 10 years ago?
Right.
I mean, they had lockdown. They had contracts with all the airports. They still have certain airports.
And that's part of the reason also why in this plan we want to emphasize the interim year as opposed to the horizon year, 2045, because even 10 years out, it's hard to know the future exactly, but it's a lot more manageable than looking out to the full extent of the plan. So
if you're designed for a system and it happens, I mean, all the country clubs that we have, if they have autonomous vehicles, just picking people up and taking them to the country club, a lot of them are very self-contained. It's a lot of trips you can a lot of air pollution, etc. you can take off. Anyway, I think I spoke wrong. Yes, Myron.
In that context, scenario planning must depend on demographic projections, economic projections. What are the sources of those?
So one of the big sources is each year, Palm Beach County Planning Department, they undergo a multi-month process of looking at all the development approvals that have occurred in the county, all the land use changes. So all of the population and economic employment data is updated on an annual basis. And then that's broken down into the 1,777 TAZ, which are traffic analysis zones in the county. So that is maintained and updated on an annual basis.
So that's based on land use planning, but what about demography? Changing demographics, which change demand.
It's a big
issue. Yeah, and that is something that, age and incomes, that's also part of that that update to that socioeconomic data.
You have those two biggest demographics in history moving at the same time.
Yeah.
The baby boomers and their kids. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
So that's all done internally within Palm Beach County. Mm-hmm. Not relied upon the state, University of Florida.
That's done, right. There's Bieber projections that are at a countywide level, but that detailed TAZ level data, that's done by Palm Beach County.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next information item, 3C, the Regional Commuter Challenge Recap. Been very patient. Gosh, we used to get through these in an hour, but they just keep getting longer. So, sorry if we're.
I'll be quick.
Don't be scared. It's a two-hour game here.
So, I just wanted to provide a recap of the commuter challenge that South Florida Commuter Services through FDOT did this past month in May. The challenge was from Monroe County all the way to St. Lucie County, so across six counties, to encourage people to take alternative modes of transportation to work. They had an app that people could log their trips by tapping in and out. They could say they were carpooling, taking transit, walking, biking, and for each trip it would calculate the total miles and the total pounds of CO2 that were saved. So South Florida Community Services partnered with the transit agencies, with NPOs, with a bunch of different partners in the region. They had a website where they had spotlights on the partners, and they tried to get the word out through media and a bunch of different ways. So in Palm Beach County, some of the partners that participated were Palm Beach Zoo, Whole Foods, PalmTran, FPL, the City of West Palm Beach, and it was also featured on the news like Channel 5. Commissioner Abrams was highlighted taking Tri-Rail, so we've shown the highlights from the challenge. More than 200 companies and municipalities participated, including these in Palm Beach County, so school districts, a few cities, major companies, the airport, and in total there were over 6,600 commuters who participated, 1,000 of them from Palm Beach County. About 950 trips were made to Palm Beach County, so people were commuting into Palm Beach County, and over 3,500 trips were made total throughout the month of May, saving over 362,000 pounds of CO2. So that's kind of a high-level recap. Next steps, they're going to create a survey to send out to all the people who participated, and they're going to create a more comprehensive, detailed report to share with all the transportation partners, including origin and destination, where people were going, where they were coming from, what modes did they take, what were their commute times and distances, and then regroup with all the partners to develop another challenge for next year and improve upon this challenge. So, and they also want to create a challenge for students at universities. So that's basically a high level. This is a snapshot that they gave us. At this point, we don't have further, more broken down data, but that's kind of like what it might look like with that origin destination data, like where the trips were going from. That snapshot's from Miami-Dade, but so we look forward to getting more information and details on this. If you have any questions, this is their contact information, and that's that. Just wanted to kind of give you a recap of it.
Any questions?
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Next, me, Robert's Rules of Order Summary.
This won't be super brief. There's no presentation with this item, but I think you'll remember 4 or 5 months ago we had put together a brief one-page summary sheet of just the main type of motions, and just so you have that as background. We did make one change because at our technical advisory committee meeting, this was like 2 months ago, I think there was kind of a confusion between the difference between a motion to postpone time certain versus a motion to table. So basically, the only change in the sheet you have now is motion to table has been added to the sheet you received a few months ago. So just to briefly highlight the main differences. So let's say at a meeting, you all feel you're not ready to make a decision. There's another piece of critical information you need, and someone wants to postpone it to another meeting. You would make a motion to postpone, and then you could have a discussion on what additional information you would like brought back, and what meeting you would like that to be brought, that item to be brought back to. A motion to table would be, say we had a presenter and they need to leave in an hour and an item is going on for a while. Someone can make a motion to table, and if seconded, all discussion must stop and a vote must occur. And then you move on to the next item, but that item would be brought back up in the same meeting. So table is just, okay, we can't talk about it this second, we need to get to other business, but we'll finish it at this meeting. Motion to postpone would be, it needs to occur at another meeting. So again, that was all I had, was just to provide that sheet for you again, just as a little cheat sheet for your own use. So.
Okay. Any questions, anyone?
Okay, thank you.
Before staff will memorize.
Printer out, have it right here.
Yeah.
You got something. Okay. Other information item, we're down to our last one. Summary points of the May 18th meeting, which are back to your package. If anybody has any questions or would like to bring anything up. Seeing none, we'll go on to the administrative items. Any member comments? Yes, Michael.
A couple of transportation things. I just spent 3 weeks in Italy, and it was all 99% of the travel was by train from Rome to Naples. I was moving at 297 kilometers an hour, which I work out to be like 186 miles per hour. So why can't we have that here? It was it takes a little effort to do the train over there, but you know, it is definitely doable. The other thing is something I've been kicking around for a while, but kind of catalyzed by Trump getting out of the Paris Accord, is going to do a do-it-yourself conversion from a Ford Ranger gas to electric. And so about a year from now, maybe you all can take a little ride around the parking lot if you want. The I've done the research, and what's wrong with the Prius is they go after range and distance. But if you don't care about that so much, I'm looking more like 80 miles an hour cruising and 90 better acceleration, better 95% of all cars out there. And if you only go 90 miles, it only takes about an hour, that might be worth it. So that's where I'm heading with that. So we'll see. Talk to me in about a year.
Electric Ranger, is that by the next year?
Ford Ranger? No. I'm going to take a 2011 Ford Ranger and the engine, put in lithium and AC, probably battery. I mean, AC motor.
It's amazing everybody forgets all the trolley cars were electric.
Exactly.
General Motors bought the trolley cars and put them out of business, basically, and kept that in all those, and put everybody in a car.
And right.
All the cities had them. Where my family is originally from. So it was really easy to get around. You just jump in the trolley car. Anyway, all right, thanks. Anyone else? Okay, next meeting is July 12th. Does anybody in known events are not going to be here? Because we now need 8 for a quorum. If so, please call the office and let them know. So we have a lot of people traveling in the summer historically. July, I'm usually welcome. And not this July, I don't think. And we need a motion to adjourn.
Motion.
Glenn, motion. And a second?
I second.
Second, Myron. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.